I'm Brandi Cruz. Today on Undivided, a dive into data shows that progressives dominate political contributions and outcomes in the state's highest court. Plus, more on the pre-sentencing arguments being made to make sure a killer gets the lowest sentence allowed by law. And Seattle Elementary students sent nasty letters to Moms for Liberty. The school district's comment on the controversy is absolutely nuts. That and more coming up today on Undivided. Remember, you can support the show for just $5 a month by signing up at UndividedPod.com. Welcome to Undivided. I'm Brandi Cruz. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. We're all business today. We had way too much fun on the show yesterday. What we're doing is serious, important work. No laughing, Nicole.
Well, it's like
no smiling.
The first half typically goes a little more serious. Second half, you know, we get a release.
No, we can't do it. We got to take this seriously. You just giggled. I already breaking my rules. No smiling, nothing. But we do have some important stories to get to today. You know, I think that there are things that we all know are happening behind the scenes in government and in politics, but it's one thing to believe it. It's another thing to have some data that helps to prove it. And there was this really interesting analysis done by Ballotpedia. You're probably familiar with it. It's like a Wikipedia for politics, essentially. It's a really wonderful source journalistically. And I would say for you too, you can find all sorts of information about past initiatives, future initiatives, political races, elections, all that stuff. Anyway, so they were looking at, you know, nonpartisan, and I kind of say that very loosely because we know a lot of things that are labeled nonpartisan really aren't nonpartisan. They were looking at nonpartisan entities and whether they could make sense of, you know, donations, political donations, and how that might influence those entities and the outcomes. And so they ended up looking at the Washington State Supreme Court, because in Washington, you can appoint Supreme Court justices, but then they do have to run for re-election. So there is a lot of money that goes into those races. The Center Square, which is a wonderful publication in Washington State, relatively new. I highly recommend you adding that to your list of news sources daily, by the way. They did a great breakdown of this study by Ballotpedia. The headline, Washington Supreme Court analysis finds progressive domination of donations and decisions. And in it, they hear from both sides about, you know, what it means that the vast, vast majority of donations to state Supreme Court candidates are coming from progressives, and that the vast, vast majority of positive outcomes in the Washington State Supreme Court favor progressives. And so I thought it was a really, really balanced article, and that's why I wanted you to go read that. But looking directly at the information from Ballotpedia, so I'll show you first just a graph that kind of helps you visualize it, because, you know, they make the progressive outcomes blue and the conservative outcomes red, and you kind of get a good idea of how off kilter it is. So of the percentage of parties with favorable decisions that have come before the Washington State Supreme Court, about 74% favored progressives. And then if you look on the flip side, parties with unfavorable decisions, it's about the same, but even higher for conservatives. And so you see kind of, and we're going to go into the highlights of the Ballotpedia report, but they're not drawing a conclusion. Ballotpedia isn't. You know, they're an unbiased entity. They're not saying that just because there is this overwhelming number of donations come from progressives, that that is the direct reason why there's overwhelming positive outcomes for progressive individuals who are involved in the cases. They're giving you the data to make that determination for yourself, which I think is fairly obvious. But let's dive into the highlights of the Ballotpedia study. So they said, among donors coded as either progressive or conservative, more than 99% of significant contributions toward the campaigns of winning state Supreme Court candidates were from progressive sources. More than 99% of significant contributions toward winning state Supreme Court candidates were from progressive sources. 97% of significant contributions to losing state Supreme Court candidates were from conservative sources. Over 43% of significant contributions came from sources in the legal field, including the subcategories of lawyer, criminal justice, criminal defense, personal injury, and trial bar. 74% of all court case parties and amici, so that's like a friend of the court, that were coded as progressive received decisions that were favorable, 16% received unfavorable decisions. So the vast majority of parties to court cases, individuals who are providing information to the court, 74% of the time, the outcomes favor progressives. 14% of the time, the outcomes favor conservatives. So not very often. And I think that that is, look, again, we go back to, we kind of knew that, right? And there are some things that are, I think, a little nefarious at play. And then there's some things that are just the reality of where our state is at. We live in a blue state. We've had the same governor for going on 12 years. Governors get to appoint Supreme Court justices when there's a vacancy. And typically, if you have a Supreme Court justice, in the same as in the U.S. Supreme Court, if you have a Supreme Court justice who's liberal or conservative, and they're considering retiring, they're going to do it at the most advantageous time for their side of the political aisle. So you're going to do it at a time when you've got a governor in office who can appoint a replacement. And then we already know, because we talked about it on the show, it is much easier to win election to a judgeship when you're already in office. And that's kind of true across the board with political positions as well. It's much harder to beat an incumbent. So when you have a governor, same governor for 12 years, you've had Democratic governors for 40 years. So of course, you're going to have the Washington State Supreme Court be one of, if not the most progressive courts in the country. And then when you get into the discrepancy in political donations, again, the winning political donations are going to progressive judges because it's hard to beat an incumbent. The incumbents are progressives. So of course, the vast majority of money that's going to winning candidates is coming from progressives. It's very, very rare, although there might be an opportunity coming up. We'll dive into that on a different show, that you'd have some sort of truly vacant. Like there's actual vacancy where you're running or whatever. And so, you know, there are some opportunities, but they're few and far between. And the real problem here is having governors of the same political party, increasingly progressive, appointing progressive judges. I mean, but you look at the outcomes and how significant the uber progressiveness of the state Supreme Court is. Look at what they did with capital gains. I mean, the capital gains tax that was passed in Olympia, which is, again, a tax on the sale of things like stocks and bonds, and they promised it would only impact the uber, uber wealthy, but we already know that that is turning out not to be true. Every other state and the IRS says that capital gains taxes are an income tax. In Washington state, an income tax that isn't just a flat rate is unconstitutional. So according to every other state and the IRS, that would have been an unconstitutional tax on capital gains. But the Washington State Supreme Court, which has become uber progressive, solid blue over years and years and years of Democratic control in the governor's office, they decided, oh no, we're going to be the only state in the union that says that this isn't an income tax at all. And so the implications of this are not only incredibly significant, it adds to the one-party rule aspect of what's happening in this state. You know, sometimes you'd think, well, at least I got the courts, right? If you don't have any balance anywhere else, at least you got the courts, where they'll definitely look at things based on the merits. And that's sometimes not the case, as we've seen with the capital gains tax. So not only do you have one-party control of the legislature, governor's office, attorney general's office, in fact, every statewide office here, but you also have really one party that is controlling, so to speak, the state's highest court. And the room for dissent in this state is getting more narrow by the day. You look at, that's why I talk so much about the initiative process and the referendum process, although still, if you've got, and we've seen it in the past, initiatives ruled, you know, that they weren't written constitutionally, and they'll find legal maneuvers to be able to throw them out, like will of the people be damned. That's why when I talk about what I'm trying to get to, which is balance in the state of Washington, that's why it's so important to me. It's not good for citizens. It's not good for citizens to have one political ideology literally in control of everything, to the point that if the citizens want to fight back through initiative or through referendum, they have so much concentrated power and authority that they can find ways to even, you know, tell the citizens no, and to say, hey, I know you did this initiative, you collect all these signatures, you got people to vote for it, whatever it is, but unconstitutional. And that's not the kind of government that we're supposed to have in the United States of America. And that's why I'm pushing so hard to have balance, be it in the governor's office or the attorney general's office or the House or the Senate. Something has to give. As far as the Washington State Supreme Court having some drastic change, that's not going to happen. Maybe ever, but for years and years and years. I mean, it took 40 years to get to this point. So that's not easy to undo. I will say So we do a daily subscriber poll every morning, and sometimes I struggle with the question, and I put one out today, and I was like, maybe the answer to that is too obvious. And then it turns out not so, because I asked you guys about, you know, power and where you see the most power in Washington state. And I thought for sure the vast majority of people would say in the state Supreme Court. So my daily subscriber poll for today on Patreon and Locals, I said, what entity do you personally believe holds the most power in Washington state government? And I gave four options: the governor's office, the attorney general's office, the state Supreme Court, or the legislature. And right now, most people are saying the governor's office. Now, if you asked me nationally, I think unequivocally, I would say the U.S. Supreme Court. I mean, that is the law of the land, and they have the power to undo virtually anything that's done, that's brought to them. And so I kind of thought that for the state Supreme Court, but I do understand some of the arguments being made, and I'll tell you my answer in a second. But I do understand some of the arguments that you're making for the governor's office. E says, all you have to do is remember 975 days. The answer is the governor, referring to the fact that you have one man who is able to put us in, you know, take control of state government, essentially, and all the decisions around the pandemic in a state of emergency for 975 days, and no one could or would do anything about it. I should note that Democrats in Olympia could have done something about it. But that's again, it goes back to one party rule. They wouldn't because of political ideology. They wouldn't because that was their team. So if there was a check on the governor's emergency power, they just didn't want to institute it. They wanted, you know, we pushed for a long time for them to push through emergency power reform, and they simply would not do it, despite the fact it was obvious they needed to. Let me see. Chris Horblet says, it was a toss-up between the Supreme Court and the AG. Sideshow Bob has an inordinate amount of power to go after individuals with petty personal vendettas. See Iman and Bob Martin. But the corrupt Supreme Court has the power through its contemptible rulings to affect everyone in the whole state. Let me see here. Travis says, it's a snake eating itself. The legislature passes laws, the court upholds them. Sideshow Bob Ferguson, does everybody call him Sideshow Bob Ferguson? Refuses to pursue cases he doesn't like, and the governor sits at the top flying around the world for climate change. My answer is the attorney general's office, at least with its current occupant. Only because, and I thought about this a lot this morning when it comes to who do I really think and what entity do I believe that has the most power, and it's kind of what Chris said. I think that you can weaponize the attorney general's office to go after private citizens who disagree with you politically. And I think that we've seen him do that. And so that to me is like the most direct power you can exert over someone, weaponizing the legal process, weaponizing your political position to go after someone in a way that can truly ruin their life. And I think that that is a lot of power when in the hands of the wrong person, which it is right now, can be a very, very dangerous thing. So anyway, I thought that was interesting information data from Ballotpedia. Again, go read that Center Square article. WA Supreme Court analysis finds progressive domination of donations and decisions. They're not making the connection for you, but I think when you read through the entire article and the information, you'll come to the conclusion that, you know, it really is this cyclical thing where you've got all this progressive money coming in, you've got progressives who are winning these seats, you've got Democratic governors galore, and so that's the court that you end up with. All right. I told you that today we would have another update for you on the pending sentencing for Joshua Ellis, who, of course, is going to be in a court of law in Pierce County on Friday. At least that's the anticipation. And he's going to be sentenced for the 2017 domestic violence murder of his ex-girlfriend, Wendy Traynor. Wendy was just 25 years old when he came in from Kentucky. They had moved there together. She moved back. The relationship was toxic. He came across the country into our state with our citizen, shot her in the head, left her for dead in her apartment in Milton. So it's just a horrifying case. We talked a lot about it yesterday. And the angle that we took on this yesterday is that you have Joshua Ellis's public defender who is racist. She is racist against white people. I mean, no question in my mind, she has filed these pre-sentencing memorandums that focus on Joshua Ellis should get the lowest sentence allowed by law because he's black. That's not hyperbole. That is what she is arguing. She makes all these arguments about how the criminal justice system, I mean, she goes back to the Reagan years. She goes back to the Nixon years to look at the outcomes in our criminal justice system and basically says that in order to make it right, you've got to have lower sentences for black offenders, you know, regardless of the heinous nature of the crime they committed. And so yesterday we really focused on the ridiculousness of the race argument. I'll say one thing that came up, I think it was from a commenter. I can't remember who said it, but I was like, you're totally right. On the race argument, before we get on to the argument that we're going to highlight today, somebody said that this should make her unfit to be a public defender because imagine if you were a white defendant and this is the public defender who's been assigned to you by the government to represent you, which is your right. And you look at here all these arguments she's making about, oh, we have to push for anti-racism and equity, and this cold-blooded killer should get the lowest sentence allowed by law. Woe is him, you know, because he's a black American. So is she not going to fight for her white defendants? Is she not going to push to get low sentences for her white defendants with the same rigor? Because don't get me wrong, you know, Mary Kay High is a public defender. She's clearly pulling out all the stops for her defendant. And I give her credit for that. I think there are a lot of public defenders who probably clock in, clock out, you know, check the boxes like, yeah, go to jail. What's wrong with you? And I do think public defenders, any defense attorney, should fight like hell for their client. That's their job, right? But the using his race as the argument, to me, I've said on the show yesterday, I think she should be disbarred for that. Because, again, of that angle of that is not what our justice system is supposed to be about. It's supposed to be blind. So you are blatantly arguing for the justice system to do exactly what it should not be doing. But then that other argument of that someone brought up, which is, yeah, if I were a white defendant, I would not want that to be my public defender because I would be worried that she's so obsessed with race, has shown an animus, frankly, even though she's white, toward white people. I'd want a different public defender. That's a real concern. That would be a very real concern. Everybody is entitled to good representation, no matter the color of their skin, no matter, you know, if they're rich or poor or what their politics are. Everyone's entitled to good representation. If you're a white defendant, would you feel like you could get good representation from Mary Kay High? After reading that memorandum, I wouldn't want her to be my defense attorney. So the argument today that I want to break down for you, to me, is just as egregious, although it's less unique. I mean, I think the blatant argument of his skin color should land him the lowest sentence allowed by law is truly, truly insane. I think this is also insane, but it's something that you hear all the time. I just haven't seen it detailed in this context in a case like this. And that is the argument that putting him in prison isn't going to make the public safer. You know, it's not doing anything for public safety to put a murderer in prison for a really long time. That's not fair to him. That's not fair to his family. So anyway, there were a couple letters submitted to the court, and both sides are able to do this. I know that Wendy Traynor's family has submitted some letters to the court for consideration as well, victim impact statements. And Joshua Ellis is certainly entitled to have people write to the court on his behalf. The interesting thing is some of the people who have written to the court on his behalf are individuals involved in some way in the legal community who have never met him, who don't know him. You know, maybe have had a phone call with him as part of, you know, gearing up to write a letter on his behalf, but don't know him. So one of the letters came from a woman named Virginia Parham. And she writes to Judge Andre Penoliver, and she introduces herself, and she says that she's supporting a reduced sentence for Joshua Ellis. She says she's the founder of Family Shoulder to Shoulder, which is a court advocacy group. And she says what they do is support incarcerated individuals and their families during their difficult court proceedings. And look, I'm fine with that. I do think everyone needs an advocate as part of that system. I would never argue against that, ever. And I do think, by the way, that it's difficult for families. I feel for the families of offenders who had nothing to do with their loved one's crime and have to live with the consequences of it in a very real way, of course. So anyway, she goes on to say, I'd like to share with Your Honor two reasons why I'm supporting Joshua Ellis. First, I do not believe that a long sentence will benefit our communities or keep them safer at all. In fact, a long sentence will just further add to Washington State's already huge incarceration rate. My second reason is more personal. I have gotten a good idea of who Joshua is through many, many phone conversations with him. To describe him is to describe a brilliant, gentle young man. A man that could do better out here in our communities as an advocate against violence rather than just another man with a DOC incarceration number. Can you imagine reading that as Wendy Traynor's family? I'll get to this next part of this in a second, but just to reflect on that. You've talked to this guy a couple times on the phone and you're saying he's a brilliant, gentle man. Tell Wendy Traynor he's gentle. Was the bullet he put in her brain put there gently? I mean, for the love. And for her to say, again, after just speaking to him on the phone, she doesn't know this guy. He could do better out here in our communities as an advocate against violence. I'll tell you what, a cold-blooded killer is the last person I want advocating against violence. That's absurd. She goes on to say, I would ask Your Honor to take a more restorative approach when sentencing Joshua. And I would ask that Your Honor proceed with a joint recommendation. A reasonable plea bargain in which Joshua could further transform and heal himself and not be locked away for a long time. Joshua is a calm and brilliant young man that I would absolutely, without hesitation, have as my neighbor. This stuff is unhinged. You believe that? Does anyone believe? Would anyone welcomely say, yeah, oh, this guy? Oh, yeah, he just got out of prison. He did 9 years. He shot his ex-girlfriend in the back of the head after he followed her across the entire country. Left her there for dead to rot for 7 days. And then there's a witness who says that they think that he actually went back to the apartment in those 7 days while her body was decomposing and stepped over it to feed his dog. Oh, yeah, I would absolutely without hesitation have as my neighbor. Well, how convenient for you to say. How convenient for you to say that you would have him as your neighbor. Well, guess what? There's a lot of Washingtonians who wouldn't want to have him as their neighbor, and rightfully so. And you're totally entitled to your opinion, but I think what's, again, astounding here is that this is someone who's got a foot in the criminal justice system, who's never met him, who's talked to him on the phone a couple times, and she's describing him as calm and brilliant and gentle. He murdered someone in the worst possible way. I always think that crimes against strangers are horrific as well. If somebody just has a propensity for violence and they'll kill someone. But to kill someone who you said you loved, that's a whole nother level of dangerous. So anyway, there's another letter. It's from, I'm going to butcher his last name, David Tryweller. We'll go with that, Tryweller. He says that he has practiced criminal defense in Washington Superior Court for over 30 years, began his career as a Pierce County prosecutor before turning to private practice. So he's a private attorney based in Seattle. So I'm going to read just a couple passages from the letter he wrote. Again, he does not know Joshua Ellis. So I don't know if this was some favor to the public defender or who he knows or something like that. But he says, since retiring from active trial practice in 2019, I've devoted time to studying Washington's sentencing system, how it came to its present form, and what can be done to remedy its flaws. Recently, I was appointed to serve on a sentencing guidelines commission committee whose purpose was to reexamine many of our criminal sentencing laws. And I'd also note, by the way, I think the last woman I wrote that letter from said she was on the Washington Criminal Sentencing Task Force. Mm-hmm. Huh, shocking. And those are Inslee appointees, right? So you've got people who are clearly sympathetic to criminals sitting on those sentencing task forces. But anyway, he says, several of the surviving family members of Wendy Traynor indicate in letters to the court that they desire the longest possible prison term to protect the public. However, as the defendant's sentencing memorandum accurately points out, long prison sentences do not make the public safer. That is because they do not deter crime, either individually or generally. We know that long sentences do not make the public safer through either deterrence or incapacitation. They do not help victims recover from their trauma. They are devastating to the incarcerated person, his family, and his community. First of all, before I go on, they don't help victims recover from their trauma? Wendy's dead. There is no recovering from that trauma. She's dead. And frankly, there is no recovering for her family and her dad and her uncle who had to find her decomposing body. So you might be right that, yeah, Joshua Ella's going to prison is never going to help Wendy recover from her trauma because she's dead. And it's never going to help her family recover from that trauma because they'll never have her again. But you act as if that means that he shouldn't serve a long sentence because they can't get over the trauma of being dead or being permanently mentally scarred by the experience. And when he says there's a long prison sentences are devastating to the incarcerated person, he should have thought about that before he took a gun to her head. What is wrong with you? And this is someone who used to be a prosecutor in Pierce County. Can you imagine? He goes on to write, extremely long sentences are also unnecessary to protect the public by incapacitating the convicted person. That is because the vast majority of convicted persons will, quote, age out of crime. This means that for a combination of reasons, those who are predisposed to commit criminal offenses simply stop doing so in their 30s. Rearrest rates after release from prison for those convicted of violent crimes, quote, fall far below new arrests among those convicted for other types of crime. Additionally, when those who have served time for a violent crime do recidivate, it is seldom for a violent crime. Consequently, there is virtually nothing to be gained for public safety by imposing more than the recommended sentence on Mr. Ellis. Virtually nothing to be gained for public safety by giving a convicted killer, a domestic violence abuser, a slap on the wrist. And this whole assertion that the vast majority of convicted persons will age out, and after their 30s, they'll just stop reoffending. Here's the thing, though. Joshua Ellis had no criminal history. The very first crime he was at least caught for committing was domestic violence murder. That was the very first thing. So you could look at, you know, maybe young gang members and they're getting into trouble, 15 years old, 16 years old, through their 20s. And by then they've had 15 years of a life of crime in and out of a system. And so, yeah, I can buy that maybe in their 30s, they're like, it's time to calm down because they've spent so much time in prison by then. But this is someone who never had a run-in with the criminal justice system until he shot Wendy Traynor in the head. I don't think that's the kind of person who's just going to age out of committing a crime. And statistically, again, they just reference these really flimsy, you know, sentencing projects as if they're not written by people who are obviously very, very biased. And you mentioned that for people who are released from prison for committing violent crimes, they recidivate at much lower rates. And it's like, well, maybe that's because the punishment of being in prison deterred them. Maybe that's because the time they spent in prison, 20 years, 30 years, deterred them from committing a crime again. But I think, moreover, this whole sentiment of, well, he doesn't need to serve 20 years because that's not going to do anything for public safety. Now, I disagree with that, but you're also missing the point. You're missing the point entirely. Prison is a punishment. Prison is a punishment for what you did. And that punishment really cannot be considered by what you might do down the road, how it might impact you down the road. You commit a crime in this country, which used to value and have respect for the rule of law. And when you commit that crime in a civilized society, there's a punishment for that crime. It doesn't matter if the punishment is going to devastate the incarcerated person, his family, and the community. I don't know who they're talking about, community. I am not devastated by it, and I am certainly a member of the community. But it's like they miss that entirely. They look at, well, keeping him in prison for more than 10 years, that's not going to help with public safety at all. It's not about public safety. It is about punishment. It's about saying, in this country, when you pick up a gun, when you use it to commit an act of domestic violence, when you use it to take a life, you have to be removed from civil society for a little while until you pay your due. And then you can get out, and that's when you get another chance to live your life differently. So yeah, they want to call it retribution. Fine. It is about retribution. It is. It is about punishment. It is. If you don't have punishment, if you don't have an outcome for your action, then you're going to do it again. And that's what we're seeing over and over and over and over again right now in our criminal justice system, especially with these young kids. you know, apply that sentiment to these kids who are out there stealing cars, getting back out, stealing cars, getting back out. The young kid who just stole a car, hit a 50-year-old and took his life. Oh, well, we can't hold them. We're just going to let them out. And, you know, we'll get no bail. Go ahead. Whatever. So we can't just let them in jail. That's not going to be good for them. That's not protecting the public. It is protecting the public. And it is showing them that there's a consequence for what they do. And maybe if some of those younger kids were receiving, you know, were having to spend a few nights in jail, a few weeks in jail, a few months in jail, didn't think they could just steal a car, commit a drive-by shooting, whatever it is, get out on house arrest, maybe they wouldn't have done it again. But you're training people to believe that, one, there are no consequences for their actions, particularly if they're Black. That's the message you're sending. That this is about equity, this is about race. And we've talked about this a lot before, about the message you're sending. Because Josh Ellis is still young. He was only 27 when this happened. So what does that make him now, 33? He's still a young guy. And the message that you're sending is, not only is the entire world out to get you, right? Because of the color of your skin, something you cannot change. Not only is every system designed to hold you down, but because of that, even when you do something that is so deeply wrong, so deeply horrific, something, an act that you had complete control over that had nothing to do with the color of your skin, even if you do that, we're going to let you off the hook because of an immutable characteristic that shouldn't matter in a court of law. This is all going to come full circle someday. Everything that's happening now, what we're teaching these kids about responsibility, about accountability, about respect for the rule of law, about the value of human life. You don't think that that's going to come full circle and smack us right in the face, then you're dead wrong. So yeah, these people can argue all they want that, oh, it's not going to protect public safety to put a murderer in prison. But people with common sense know that it will, and that it's not just about protecting the public. It's about making sure that bad people know in this country there are consequences for bad behavior. We will have one more segment on the show tomorrow about the Wendy Traynor case. Again, the sentencing is coming up Friday. And so we don't have a show on Friday, but we'll certainly let you know as soon as we know what the sentencing outcome is. All right. I've been talking about the First Mark Challenge. I think it's a wonderful opportunity to see if you can save a little money in your household. You might not be able to, but the nice thing about the First Mark Challenge is First Mark Insurance never charges you a dime to do it. So you've got, let's say, like Mike and I did, you've got all your different insurance policies. You know, you got your homeowner's insurance with one place. You've got your life insurance with the other. You've got your car insurance. For Mike and I, we had two different car insurance companies. So you've got all that out there. What are you going to do on your own? You're going to go call each of them every single and be like, hey, I need a better price. I need a better price. Or you could have all your insurance run through First Mark Insurance. They could handle it. They can be your conduit, go-between with the insurance companies, and they will proactively make sure every year that you still have the best price and you still have the best coverage. It's not quick. You can't do it in 15 minutes or less, but the First Mark Challenge is absolutely worth it.
How much time did it take for you?
Couple hours.
Okay. So total. All in a couple hours. Yep. From the time we gather the information, do the presentation and go through mm-hmm. everything, it's a couple hours of time. Yeah. Right. And so, and I would say that's probably on the high end.
Yeah.
Right.
It ranges. We were very chatty.
Yes, exactly. Anywhere from an hour to 2 hours is the investment in time to find out, and there's no obligation. There's no extra fees if you become a First Mark client. We are paid the same way every other insurance agency in the state of Washington is paid. We're paid by the insurance company that is the writer of your business. And so, yeah, there's nothing to lose.
Yeah, and if you're in the middle of insurance policies, they will take care of that and get you a check in the mail for the difference. That's what happened to Mike and I. I think he'd already paid out the homeowner's insurance for the year, and so he just got a check back for the difference. So important to know that as well. All right, firstmarkinsurance.com, firstmarkinsurance.com, local company, veteran-owned, been in this business for a really long time, and the best part is they work for you, not the insurance company, so they've got your back. Okay, a couple updates on some local stories. So we've been mentioning, and I kind of joked about it on the show the other day because we had a good fun calling this initiative, anti-initiative hotline, sending people around because, of course, you've got And I anticipate more being turned in, but you've got Let's Go Washington running these six initiatives. A lot of them are anti-tax initiatives. The one that got turned in last week is to repeal the carbon tax, which has increased gas prices so much. And so progressives are losing it. They're like, oh my gosh, if that goes to voters, that thing's going to pass. And, you know, so they're painting it as, oh, this is dangerous. It's going to ruin the environment, whatever. So they are launching this full-fledged effort to go out there and try to interrupt this continued signature gathering process, to fearmonger the public about what these initiatives do, to lie to the public about what these initiatives do. So anyway, I laughed about it on the show earlier this week. We had a great deal of fun with it, but it's getting pretty serious. And it's another one of those things where, gosh, I wish the Secretary of State's office can I hope that they're still willing to help us come up with common sense, bipartisan ways to protect this process, because what's happening right now is insane. You know, I'll give some of these anti-initiative folks credit for being creative. I'll get to that in a moment. But, you know, they're out. So, for instance, we've had a lot of reports, and we're trying to collect a video as well, of signature gatherers being screamed at by these people, of these progressive groups sending out these anti-initiative individuals whenever they hear about a signing location, trying to get them kicked off the property so they can't collect signatures places. So they are trying to actively take away your right and your ability to sign one of these things, which is so deeply wrong to me. Again, it's just about voters voting. I mean, you talk so much about, oh, threats to democracy. You're trying to remove lawful signature gatherers by tattling on them, by filing complaints against them, by showing up and screaming and making a scene so people just feel completely turned off by the whole situation. That's wrong to me. I got sent pictures of a couple flyers. One of them, again, these are flyers being handed out to people who are faced with, hey, do I want to sign this petition? Well, read this flyer first. Here's what this flyer says. Don't sign extreme petitions that set us back. Again, there's that freaking word extreme again. Is it really extreme to want lower gas prices? Of course it's not. These people are unhinged. It says, circulators may tell you these are reasonable, common sense measures to improve Washington. However, they are funded by one extreme multimillionaire who's trying to dodge the taxes he owes to our communities and to undo progress we made. Okay, first of all, let me comment on that before I read the rest. So Brian Haywood, who's funding these, he is rich. He's acknowledged that. He talks about it on the show. He's using his own money to do this. One of them I can see being relevant to that line there saying, oh, he's trying to dodge the taxes he owes. It sounds like he's like, he doesn't pay taxes. Like he has this back, you know, there's a bill that of taxes that he's owed. That's stupid. They're talking about the capital gains tax, which, yeah, he is someone who would be subjected to a tax on capital gains. But if that were the case, if he was just trying to use his money to repeal the tax on capital gains, you could make an argument that, oh, here's a rich guy, he doesn't want to pay it. Although it is unconstitutional, that's a good argument against it in and of itself. But what would be in it? We asked Brian this on our show. What would be in it for a multimillionaire to also spend his own money trying to lower gas prices? You think Brian Haywood, when he rolls up to the gas pump, cares if it's $4 or $5 personally? He probably notices it, like, gosh, that got expensive, but he doesn't care in terms of, it doesn't hurt his pocket. So why is he doing it? It's not some rich guy who's trying to get out. Do you think he cares about whether it does not make or break him if gas is $3, $4, $5? But he's doing it because it's wrong. And they lied about it. And they're making it about the environment as if the only policies they can come up with to help the environment are things that hurt the working class. So anyway, the flyer goes on to say, the petitions they're asking you to sign take aim at our kids and their schools. No, they don't. Working families trying to afford childcare, seniors who benefit from long-term care, and clean energy solutions that tackle the glowing climate crisis. Yeah, again, if you can't tackle the climate crisis while also not like putting people in the poorhouse, then you're incompetent at your job. But this whole idea that, oh, long-term care for seniors. No, we're talking about the long-term care tax, which, hey, they can keep it. The initiative of the six, one of them is to make the long-term care tax optional. So you can decide as an individual, do I want it or do I not want it? Because if you don't want it, then it's just socialized long-term care. And you're being forced by the government to pay for something that you're never going to use. So if you want to use it, Fuse Washington, or in this case, this is SEIU. This is a flyer being handed out by a very powerful union. Very powerful pro-Democrat, pro-progressive union. So if your people want it, and that's why, right? They benefit from long-term care tax. Of course the union's going to say that. They benefit from all these taxes. Of course they're going to say they're extreme when they're all, they are just reasonable common sense. Read them for yourself. Don't listen to me. So anyway, here's the one that I'll give them credit for it being creative. I'm still looking into, I've been told who's handing these out, but I haven't been able to verify it. And so I want to be able to actually verify it before I tell you, but there's some background there. But anyway, one of the other things happening to these signature gatherers, they're being offered jobs. This progressive entity is offering them jobs because there are paid signature gatherers. There are a lot of people you'll see out there collecting signatures for, because they believe in it. You know, we did that just for as volunteers. But to run an initiative gathering process this big, you do have to have paid signature gatherers. Both sides use it. Brian Haywood is using them here. So what these progressive groups are doing is they're handing them a flyer suggesting that they've got a job for them where they can make a bunch of money so they don't have to do this. Isn't that crazy? So they're saying a four-week licensing program, do 15 submitted applications per week. We'll pay you a flat $1,200. It says that you can make a $2,000 bonus if you get licensed and appointed within the first 30 days. I'm trying to look into what the job is specifically that they're offering them. But isn't that, it says anything below, so that's creative. I will give them that. It's like they're saying, hey, you're doing this because you're getting paid. We'll pay you more to do something else. But it just shows the lengths that they're willing to go to, like coughing up more cash for these signature gatherings, as if it's like, now you're almost in this headhunting situation, right? It's like, oh, pay, you know, collect signatures and we'll give you this much. Oh, don't collect signatures and we'll give you this much. Come on, the initiative and referendum process has gotten out of control. I don't see why we can't live in a space where if citizens want to sign something, they feel empowered to sign it, to learn about it, to read it, and to make a decision if they want to participate in that part of our democratic process. And then if it goes to voters, you get a vote. Yeah, I know that that's a little Pollyannish, and I'm not saying that there can't be some messaging, because I wouldn't put it past some initiatives in the past to lie about what the initiative is about. But these are very simple. It's like, hey, do you want the carbon tax to go away? Yes or no? You know, that's do you want lower gas prices? Yes or no? So to fearmonger, to lie, to harass, to go to the extent of saying, leave this job, we'll give you another job, is pretty wild. It also shows how freaked out they are by these initiatives. You know, the other five, if they've got enough, imagine if all six of them get enough signatures by the end of the year, and the legislature has given all six of these really huge initiatives to make a decision on. By the way, if you're out, if you see any of this activity, any of these flyers, any of the harassment, please get a video. I'm trying to document it to show the changes that need and the protections that need to be put in place for initiative gatherers. So please, please do it. And by the way, I will, on the record right now, where's my constitution? Hand a constitution. If we've got in the future some democratic initiative, even if I do not like it, and this sort of behavior is being perpetrated by the right, I promise you, I will be just as mad about it. And I will fight back about it just as hard. Because there's nothing that should interfere or intimidate people out of supporting something they want to support. All right. Let's see. Oh, I had to fit this in quick. What is wrong with the state Democratic Party? So Giving Tuesday was yesterday. I know it's like, well, Black Friday, Small Business Saturday, Cyber Monday. Mm-hmm. Giving Tuesday. So we all know what Giving Tuesday is about, right? You give to a charity. You give to a good cause, nonprofit charity. Mm-hmm. The state Democratic Party thinks that's them. Although they are charity cases once in a while. Today is Giving Tuesday, they tweeted. Washington Dems work around the clock to continuously safeguard our democracy and the values that we hold. And as we approach 2024, this commitment is more crucial than ever. Be a part of the fight for democracy. Giving Tuesday. I tweeted at him, I said, Giving Tuesday is for charities, you absolute weirdos.
Because I like the weirdos.
First of all,
part.
I know you're like a charity case, but then I think about it in the context of what we just talked about. Basically, they're going to take that money, they're going to turn around, they're going to give it to groups that are trying to actively thwart your ability to participate in the democratic process. Like, look, I know this isn't them storming the U.S. Capitol, but it has the same effect. They want to disrupt democracy for people who disagree with them. Anyone who wants to disrupt democracy for people who disagree with them is wrong. And please, I really hope nobody donated to the state Democratic Party on Giving Tuesday. All right, another update on the Echo Glen escape. Ugh, this is not a surprise to me. Look, you don't end up at Echo Glen because you stole a candy bar, right? There are some bad kids at Echo Glen, and there have been escapes from this juvenile detention facility, which is in Snoqualmie, over and over. They usually involve an assault on a guard. Police will send out something telling people in the area, lock your doors, because they know these kids are dangerous. Now we're learning more information about the three teens who escaped earlier this week from Echo Glen. From MyNorthwest.com, three teens who escaped Echo Glen Detention Center have violent criminal histories. So one of the teens, 16 years old, he's at Echo Glen for killing two people. When he was 14, you probably remember this. He was 14. He had two separate shootings in Renton, killed two strangers when he was 14 years old. Killed a 22-year-old man outside of Safeway, October 20 to 21. A few months later, shot a 54-year-old man outside a Circle Food convenience store. And this was random. Mm-hmm. So you've got a 16-year-old in this juvie center who killed two people at random, no reason, in Renton, was 14 years old, and you've got a facility that is so dang insecure that he can just get out. Not the first time a killer has escaped from Echo Glen. The other escapee is a 16-year-old and a 17-year-old. So they have a history at Echo Glen. They were both involved in a prison riot at Echo Glen, which has happened. There were some really horrifying ones there. The 16-year-old, also a convicted killer, he was part of the five that escaped in August, last year. Or this past August, I think it was. So he's already done this, and he's a convicted killer. That's crazy. So here's the thing. There has to be an investigation into the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. There has to be. If you can't, as a state entity, protect the public, yes, run a juvenile detention center, try to rehabilitate these kids, good luck. But if you can't do that and also make sure they don't escape, that they don't have so much leeway that they can't escape, then you shouldn't be running it. And we go down to Green Hill in Chehalis, where they got a drug trafficking operation in there. And the police try to break it up, and they had to get a search warrant. And the governor's office basically says, we got this handled. I mean, that's what he said. They wanted the attorney general to investigate, the attorney general who wants to be the next governor. They're all like, all is good. All is not good. The Department of Children, Youth, and Families, heads need to roll. There needs to be an investigation. I would pray to God that it could be bipartisan. There's no reason it shouldn't be. We're not talking about making life miserable for these kids. I know we're all hands off on juvenile offenders, but some of them are murderers. And I need you to be as hands-on as you can need to be to keep them incarcerated and not running out in communities with the Snoqualmie Police Department being like, lock your windows and lock your doors. Be vigilant every five freaking months. Department of Children, Youth, and Families, lawmakers, please make it a priority to force an investigation. Governor Jay Inslee, Attorney General Bob Ferguson, they blocked a police investigation. Where is the accountability? Please tell me the accountability we're going to give Bob Ferguson isn't 4 years in the governor's mansion. Please tell me that. Crazy stuff. All right, before we get to unbelievable, that's before we even got to unbelievable. Unbelievable. Oh, no fun today. Sorry. Serious stuff. EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. I actually got a text from somebody today saying, hey, we're 7 days in. Sorry, I haven't responded to you yet. I won't use your name on the air. It's because I was busy. I saw your text that they are 7 days in, already seeing the results. And I think that's the nice thing about the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic program. It's not easy. It is not magic. Like, you're going to have to eat better. You're going to have to follow their plan. But if you do, I lost almost 30 pounds in 2 months on the program. Started on November 1st of last year. By the end of the year, I was down almost 30 pounds, lost 37 pounds total. And again, you got to stick to it. Like, if you're not good at following a program, you probably won't be good at the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic plan, but they give you all the tools you need to succeed. And you start to see the weight come off so quickly that was really the motivator for me, where other diets had failed, where I felt like, I'm not getting any progress. So EastsideWeightLossClinic.com, EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. Start by just scheduling a free 15-minute consultation with our friend, Dr. Ryan Coogan. He can answer any questions that you've got about the program and whether it's right for you before you commit, because not every weight loss program is going to be right for every person. So make sure that this one's right for you before you dive in. All right. Do we have two unbelievables today? We probably just have one. Just one. Oh yeah. Are we kicking one of them? Okay. Yeah. We'll kick the second one. Why? We keep going late. I'm just having too much fun.
I know.
I've got stuff to do after the show today. Anyway, some Seattle elementary school students sent nasty little love letter. I'm calling nasty love letters because they look good, but the content's not good. To Moms for Liberty. This went viral. Seattle Public Schools is now responding, and their response is frankly un-freaking believable. Isn't Moms for Liberty the organization that got labeled like a terrorist group or something, like a domestic?
Yeah, I think they did.
Like just crazy stuff. So it's moms who are sick of what's happening in schools, essentially, right? Sick of like gender ideology and all that. Yeah, look that up, man. I'm pretty sure it was Moms for Liberty. So anyway, you know, they get called right wing and all this stuff. And I don't know everything Moms for Liberty has ever said or done. I generally speaking know what they stand for. But I for sure know that elementary school students at the behest of their teacher should not be spending time in school writing nasty grams to Moms for Liberty. But that is exactly what happened at a Seattle school. So Moms for Liberty sent out a tweet of the package and the contents of the package that they got from this Seattle school. It says, Seattle Public Schools, they said in a tweet, Moms for Liberty, Seattle Public Schools are spending class time indoctrinating and weaponizing your children. The building of the Red Guard in America. So some of the, and again, it's like, it looks like, you know, little drawings that you might hang on your fridge, except I don't think Moms for Liberty is going to hang these on your fridge. It says, LGBTQ rights are human rights. Okay, that's not so bad. That one's fine, right? This one has a broken heart. My heart when people are homophobic. This one says, dear Moms for Liberty, stop bullying and excluding LGBTQ youth and families. This one's the real whopper. Gay is slay. Stop being a rat. You guys, this is literally insane. So this is, what's this? I gotta look quick. I think it was middle school, not elementary school. Let me just double check. Hold on. Sorry. Is it middle school? I think it was middle school. I just want to be sure.
Either way, those are pretty young drawings.
Yeah. Concerned middle school students. Yeah, those kids, those look like a fourth grader.
Yeah.
This what is are you doing coloring in middle students. School? So there was, let's see, one of our eagle-eyed viewers, Andrew Gustafsson, was looking at the letter that was sent with it. And actually on the letter that was sent with these images to Moms for Liberty, it's signed. It's not like they sent it, you know, anonymously. It's signed from Anne Christensen, who works at this middle school, at Jane Addams Middle School. And so Andrew Gustafsson on Twitter put out the letter, put out a picture of Anne Christensen, who teaches social studies. But then critically, he also looked up, good for him, the OSPI report card for Jane Addams Middle School, where you've got something like 40% of kids failing to meet English standards, 50% failing to meet math standards, half, 34% failing to meet science standards. You wonder why. It's because they got these middle schoolers drawing weird, really childlike images. So that just makes me concerned about their development as it is. Middle schoolers spending time at school drawing these hate grams to send to Moms for Liberty. Thanks to Anne Christensen. I'm sure that that has nothing to do with their low test scores. So Seattle Public Schools is now responding to this, which I would, Como News, I'm surprised that Como News covered this. So Como News has this project called Crisis in the Classroom, which I love. We were talking about that earlier. It was like, Como News, every once in a while, I'll give you a little, okay?
Oh, yeah.
So they reached out, and I'm surprised, because usually the mainstream media, I think, would just ignore it, right? Would just say, like, oh, no, that has to do with, like, transgender issues and kids, and we're not going to cover it. But they did cover it. So what the response they got from Seattle Public Schools is insane. It's even crazier. It's even crazier than the.
They haven't responded to me.
It's even crazier than the letters themselves.
Mm-hmm.
It says, when Crisis in the Classroom asked SBS to confirm the authenticity of the cards, a spokesperson said, quote, the materials in question were sent last spring as an independent activity and not part of the school curriculum. Yeah, but they were sent by the teacher, signed by the teacher. That's not an independent. We know.
Yeah.
First of all, we know it's not part of the freaking school curriculum, dum-dums. Exactly. Like, we know that.
It wasn't in free time.
That's
it was
the
part
problem.
Of right? curriculum.
Ridiculous. You act like these kids went and did it at home and mailed it individually. No, they mailed it as a class. And then it says, we firmly uphold the rights of our students, staff, and families to express their authentic selves. Okay, fine. But that doesn't mean that they should be using class time to do this. That's nuts. Como also noted that they attempted to reach this teacher to ask about her reasoning for this activity. They said they used the teacher's school-issued email address. They received an automatic response stating that Christensen is, quote, currently on a leave of absence and not checking emails. So I don't know if that's true. I don't know if the leave has anything to do with this, if it's completely independent of this. No idea. But that is some unhinged stuff. Like, look, we know, and we've talked about this in schools, that you have sometimes teachers that go off the rails. And you can't stop all of that. You can respond to it, though. When you have a teacher that does something that's outside the approved curriculum, which Seattle Public Schools has admitted that this isn't the approved curriculum, but it was an activity they were doing, and they support their ability to express themselves. So now you have not only a teacher that goes completely off the rails, but a school district that then stands up for that teacher going completely off the rails. And we're talking about middle school kids. Wild. Okay, we are going to dip outside of Washington State in a moment because it's a story we skipped yesterday that I do not want to skip again today. But first, Wes Jones and his team at sellwithwes.com. If you're looking for a real estate agent, if you're trying to put your home on the market, maybe you're done with a rental property in Seattle or Tacoma, you're trying to put that on the market, which I know is happening a lot right now. Check out a few real estate agents, but don't choose one until you visited sellwithwes.com. He and his team have some innovative offerings you're not going to see anywhere else, including their Listing Boost Concierge service, where they'll come in, they'll help you make changes or updates, improvements to your home before it goes on the market. Susan in Federal Way utilized that service, and her results were fantastic.
I told him up front that I was very interested, that I did not have the time or the finances to do what needed to be done. And he immediately jumped in with, well, I do. And I would say in 2 to 3 weeks, they had landscaping done. They had all the painting done. The new floors were put in. All the lighting was put in. It just was all so fast. And the rest is history. It was on the market for 7 days. I was able to get well over listing price.
To be specific, Susan got 20 offers, sold it for 15% over list price, and ended up getting $200,000 more than an investor offered her before the renovations. Yeah, $200,000 more because she didn't sell it to some guy who wanted to flip it. She got in touch with Wes Jones, sellwithwes.com. He made it happen for her. So sellwithwes.com. He'll give you a free market analysis if you've got concerns about the state of the real estate market. He can give you some honest advice there. But you can start by simply using his home value calculator to see how much your home is worth. It might be worth more than you think. All right, before we dip outside of Washington State, a few people telling me on the letters to the Moms for Liberty, it was done at a GSA club outside of class, but it was still done with the participation of the teacher. Is that a student alliance?
I think they're guessing that. I'm not sure if
no, there were multiple people who said, hey, that was done by with the gay student alliance, which is fine, but it doesn't change the fact that the teacher was involved, mailed them off. Doesn't change it at all, but I'm glad it wasn't done in class. Like, hey, kids, come in today. We're writing hate grams to Moms for Liberty. But yeah, it must have been on there somewhere. Okay. Yeah. Thank you for that clarification. Mm-hmm. All right. Dipping outside Washington State. We skipped this yesterday because we were going long. I refuse to skip it today because to me, so here, let me just set it up with this. I don't like cancel culture. I don't like going after people's jobs. I just, you know, having been in those positions where like everything you do is under the microscope and one little mistake and it's like your life is ruined. I don't believe in that. However, there is a story going on right now and some backlash against an article a sports columnist wrote that I think is backlash to a level that might help us get out of this crazy time we're in. With this just woke gone wild. So the original article was posted on Deadspin. And it was posted by a columnist named Karone Phillips. But for our purposes, I'm going to pronounce it Karen. Because it just seems right. So and I will note, because I think it's relevant based on what he talks about, that the columnist is Black. So it has to do with a young Kansas City Chiefs fan. So at a recent game that was held in Las Vegas, I believe, it wasn't even at the Chiefs' home turf, a young fan was seen wearing a Indian headdress and then blackface, according to this author. The headline, "The NFL needs to speak out against the Kansas City Chiefs fan in blackface and a native headdress." It says, "Are you going to say anything, Roger Goodell?" Goodell. People are like, that's not how you say it. Goodell. And then this is the quote from the article. "This is what happens when you ban books, stand against critical race theory, and try to erase centuries of hate. You give future generations the ammunition they need to evolve and recreate racism better than before." So in it, he's using this picture of this Kansas City Chiefs fan, which is just a young kid. Just a young kid in this headdress, very elaborate. And the kid is looking off to the left, so you only see the right side of his face, and it's completely black. And that was an image that was taken from CBS. So CBS was showing this kid cheering on CBS. But here's the problem that was quickly pointed out once Deadspin published this article. When the kid faced forward, you could see that his face was actually painted black and red, right, which are the colors of the Kansas City Chiefs.
Correct.
And so it was clearly painted to be the team's colors. So people are pushing back against this Karen Phillips, saying, "Hey, like, you're lying. The picture you showed, calling it blackface, doesn't show the whole story." This was his response. "For the idiots in my mentions who are treating this as some harmless act because the other side of his face was painted red, I could make the argument that that makes it even worse. Y'all are the ones who hate Mexicans but wear sombreros on Cinco." Okay, whatever that means. But again, this is classic, by the way. You see this a lot in the Seattle blogosphere. You call them out on something that's inaccurate and they double down. They're like, "Actually, that just proves my point," which is when you know someone's just absolutely full of it. "So now it's racist against two groups, black people and Native Americans." Yeah, here's the problem with that little wrinkle. The kid's Native American. It turns out that not only is the kid Native American, his grandfather serves on the Santa Ynez Band of Chumash Indians. So he's got like a grandpa who's on a Native American tribal in. Board, you yeah, know? Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so it's just absolutely insane. And the mom like pushed back against this article, along with all the backlash that it's all been just out there. And the mom also shared, and this goes to, so that takes care of, it should take care of the racism against Native Americans aspect of this. And then the racism against black aspects of this, that the black author of that article says is a problem. Well, the mom shared the video of her son cheering, and he's doing the tomahawk chop, mm-hmm. you know, and in the background on the sidelines, black football players start doing the tomahawk chop with him. And so people are pointing it out to the Deadspin author, like, "Hey, they don't think it's racist. They think it's part of cheering and whatever it is." And I'm not saying that there haven't been some aspects of sports that need a little tweak, right? Like, hey, if there's a native tribe that's really deeply offended by that, like, let's reassess or whatever.
I actually think the chop has been banned in some stadiums. Yeah. And then in Kansas City, you can't wear the headdress. They would have asked him to remove that before coming in.
But he was able to do it because it was elsewhere.
In Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm. But I think the key is that here you've got this national sports writer mm-hmm. who's trying to ruin a little kid's life, saying he's wearing blackface. When it's pointed out that it's actually team colors, black and red, he's like, "Well, that's even worse." So he's racist against blacks. This little kid, like, who's how old? Have you seen can you look up how old he is?
Yeah.
Sorry, I always throw things at you midair.
You're good.
I mean, he's got to be like, what, 7, 8? He's tiny. And, oh, well, now this little kid that I'm going to blast all over the internet is not only racist against blacks, he's racist against Native Americans. Turns out he's Native American. And then turns out there are a lot of people who are black who aren't offended by it. And I'm not saying, like, look, I'm not black, obviously. I'm white. So if you're going to be offended by something, fine. But using your platform as a national sports writer to not only try to ruin a little kid's life, but to use a picture that is obviously not telling the full story has created a backlash that is one of the most severe and consistent I've seen. I have seen very few people standing up for what this writer did. And as much as I hate, you know, pylons and all of that, I've been subjected to them as well. I think that this is what it's going to take, a forceful rejection of that kind of woke idiocy to stop it from happening.
Well, I think it's going to take more than one.
Well, I know, but it's going to continue to take it. I mean, you saw Bud Light, you saw Target,
right.
You know, and then you see this and I think, It is so forceful, mm-hmm. so swift. And people are like, not, you know, I think there was a time where it's like, well, I'm not going to, you know, I'm white or whatever it is, so I'm not going to speak out against this because I don't know what I'm talking about. But no, you can look at that and be like, that's ridiculous. That's a kid. Did you find out how old he is?
No, nothing actually mentions it. Not even the mom's
thing. He's got to be like 7 or 8. I mean, he's super young. Mm-hmm. And so, and it's just, it's ridiculous. I mean, if you want to have, again, you know, a more broad conversation about face painting, but there was also this story, this Kin California. Mm-hmm. And we just tacked this on because it is relevant. So, you know, the eye black that the football players sometimes wear, maybe hunters will wear. So this kid was suspended for 2 days for wearing eye black to a game. And yeah, he put it in the triangle. Like, you see NFL players do that sometimes where it's not just the strip under their eye. It's like down further.
Right,
it's like a triangle, right?
Yeah. I mean, his is a little more than that. It's almost like a fake beard.
Like a beard, right.
But
again, it's clearly, this has been, kids have done this in sports forever. NFL players do this all the time. Mm-hmm. So this kid gets suspended from school for 2 days.
And nobody had a problem with it, to clarify. Yeah, like, nobody at the game asked him to remove it. Everybody was in on it. And then a week later, somebody notified the superintendent.
Yeah. And then he gets called to the office. It says, student's father said he had had fun, great night without any trouble. While he was at the game, no one accused the student of being in blackface. A black security guard even told him to add more face paint, the student's father said. But 5 days after the game, the father was called into the principal's office, blah, 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 suspended for 2 days. And now the dad's fighting this. I think he's pushing back in court, which he should. But it's going to take these things to look at that and say, that's absurd. Like, that's going too far. It's one thing to make sure that people are understanding of cultural norms and when they might be being offensive. Like, I get the headdress thing, I do, but at the same time, you have a kid who's Native American, whose dad sits on the board of a tribe. Now, that doesn't give him the right to do whatever he wants, but at the end of the day, he's a little kid. He's a little kid. CBS was showing him on TV, and this national sports writer used his platform to paint a little kid as racist, a little kid as this awful human being because he had his face painted for a football game. Man, if that's not peak insanity, I don't know what is. All right, questions and comments for the stream coming up next. But first, Zach Abraham with Bulwark Capital joins us every week on the show. He'll be joining us tomorrow to talk a little bit about how spending went during this little blockbuster after Thanksgiving spending spree Americans go on and what that might tell us about the economy. When we had him on the last time, we were talking about gold and how, you know, Costco had been selling these little 1 ounce things of gold. And we asked him, hey, we hear about this all the time. Is gold a good investment?
People think about gold the wrong way. First of all, gold should not be an investment. It's not an investment. Why is it not an investment? Because it doesn't have any cash flow, right? There's also no one-off thing that makes gold go up. So people go, well, inflation does. And I go, oh, really? Well, look at how gold performed last year when inflation was the hottest in 40 years. It did virtually nothing. Gold is a wonderful, wonderful insurance policy. Take it from a guy that has been around the industry, that has made a lot of money investing in gold mining. It's great to have 5, maybe even 7% of your portfolio value in gold, but think of it not as it's an insurance policy if things go wild. People are always trying to sell it. It's why you're here on late at night, move your IRA into gold. Absolutely. Do not listen to that. Do not do that. Having some is fine. Do not convince anybody to get you to go all in.
Yeah, we learned from Zach that he actually grew up in a family that was like gold miners, which is pretty cool because I like that show, Gold Rush. Anyway, always sound advice from our friend Zach Abraham with Bulwark Capital. He and his team at Bulwark specialize in risk management. So given the state of the economy, the uncertainty, how can you manage your risk so that you can enjoy your retirement? Nobody wants to put their retirement at risk. So if you want to not only get his advice, but hear his advice, you can hear it weekly for free on his radio show, knowyourriskradio.com. knowyourriskradio.com. Some questions and comments from the live stream. Let me see here. So Heidi Ryan says, so we're talking about the Josh Ellis case and some of the really bizarre arguments that have been made to make sure he gets a low sentence on Friday. Heidi Ryan says he won't be a danger to the community, just his next girlfriend. And honestly, that's a real thing. His first real serious relationship, when it went south in his 20s, he killed her. How many of us had heartbreak in our 20s? Where we were like, yeah, I cried it out. I didn't travel 3,000 miles and shoot someone in the head. That's an unhinged human being. Liz, when you take away consequences, that type of crime goes up. We've been seeing it with minor crimes for years, 100%. Austin Coleman, how long is the minimum sentence? 123 months. So when he was first sentenced in 2019, because he got overturned on appeal, he got 280 months in prison, which is about 24 years. Not only did he get the sentence for murder in the second degree, high end of the range, but they also added on a mandatory 5-year enhancement for using a firearm. So I think that's 280 months. My gosh. So hold on, 280 divided by 12. Yeah, 23.3 years. And so what they're proposing now is half of the standard range. So from 220 to 123 months. So he could be out by late 2025, early 2026. You're talking about 8.5 years for murdering someone in cold blood with a gun. Wild stuff. Yeah, Glenn points out Wendy's sentence can't be reduced. Exactly. Okay. Two Ladies Midwest Adventures. Brandy, I really miss your book review and commentary. I wish we could slip this in once a week if possible. Any thoughts on this? You have read some of the most amazing books. I used to do a book review. I think I only did that for like a month or two at the very beginning of Undivided.
You have time to read?
I do have time to read.
Well, that's good.
You just got to make time, Nicole.
Well, I do. I just make it in the car and have it on Audible.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's and it's just celebrity.
There's a lot of things I'd like to add to the show. And again, we're coming up toward the end of the year. And we did it last year as well, where it's sort of soliciting some things you guys would like to see. And actually, this Thursday, we're having our November live subscriber Q&A. Where you can join me virtually and we just do a little Q&A and chat. But that might be a good time to bring some of your suggestions and we can talk about some of those things. Next year is going to be a huge year. And we think it's going to be a big year for the podcast as well, because it's our first big election year doing Undivided. And that's like our bread and butter, right? So if there are aspects that you want us to consider doing or tweaking, I mean, we work for you, so we'd really like to hear that. So I think Thursday might be a good time to bring that up. We'll fit in Leland's super chat before we move on. Leland, because we got Jonathan Cho coming in. We're taping an interview with Jonathan Cho for our show tomorrow on a really interesting topic that he's been working on. So hold on, Jonathan. We'll be right there. Leland Taylor says on this kid being vilified in the national media, if we don't mock the absurd, we are choosing to live life absurdly. Cancel the Karen. Carone. Isn't it perfect that his name sounds like Karen?
My friend Karen really hates that.
Oh, I'm sure she does. Okay, let's get to, oh gosh, it's a good one. Our closing sanity check. People unhinged about Melania Trump. So there was a memorial for former First Lady Carter, who passed away, and we hadn't talked about that on the show, but you know, she'd been getting up in there in the years, and so I don't think it was a particular surprise. But anyway, so there were a lot of heads of state there, important people. Melania Trump was there, and the Newsweek, Melania Trump's outfit at Rosalynn Carter Memorial Service turns heads. Okay, all right, what'd she wear?
It's so plain. It's so just she, a little jacket. It's,
she wore this like tweed,
yes,
blackish gray jacket that's belted, very elegant as she usually is.
Something
she
I never think got wear. Credit.
I love it.
Yes,
and there was this a lot of tweets about it, but one person said she might as well have "I really don't care, do you" on the back of that coat. Disrespect, because it's not black. Because it's not black. They're criticizing her. She's wearing a tweed blackish gray.
And it's her jacket.
And she underneath it, she has a black dress.
But they're pointing out this picture. There's a picture of the of everybody at the service. And she is in gray. Everybody else looks black, like they're in black. And then, but there is like a man in a white shirt behind, a few rows behind her. And a lady in a green jacket off to the right. So I think it's insane. Obnoxious it to is say unhinged. That that's like a rule.
It's not a rule, and it's not offensive. And you have to search all the things happening in politics that the mainstream media should be using its time and energy to actually push back on. And they decided to use the power of the Fourth Estate to go after Melania Trump for wearing a tweed grayish black coat at a memorial service. That's insane. That's some really unhinged stuff. And, you know, I think Melania Trump, when you look at, you know, when Carter passed away, there were all these, like, I don't remember what channel I was watching. It might have been like TLC or History Channel. I think it was History Channel. And then they had like a little in memoriam, you know, thing pop up with her face that was really nice. But I was thinking to myself immediately, do you think they'd ever do that for Melania Trump?
Right.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. It is really, really, because, you know, the first ladies used to be kind of off limits where it's like they do their thing and you're not, you know, mean to them. But then they just gush over the Democratic first ladies. Just, oh, fawn over with mm-hmm. the fashion. The fashion of Jill Biden. I'm like, the fashion of Jill Biden. It's fine. But Melania Trump was beautiful and fashionable. And because of who her husband is, she just got crapped on and she continues to. And it's so weird and unhinged. And I don't know how people get through their day, because your life must be miserable if you care about stuff like this. All right, that has been our sanity check for today. And that has been today's episode of Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. We'll see you back here on the live show tomorrow. A lot of good content for you for our final live show of the week.